Good morning. On today's programme, we hear about the sand and floral carpets of Tenerife to celebrate Corpus Christi, and about Danish drivers' discontent at new speed limits. But first we go to Japan. Between the 17th and 19th century, the country closed its borders to the outside world for over 200 years. Since the start of the pandemic, it pretty much did the same. But now finally, after 2 years of self-imposed isolation, Japan is reopening. From Japan, Brian Gaynor reports.
You probably haven't heard of New Chitose Airport. It is the main gateway to Hokkaido, Japan's second largest island, a region with approximately the same population as Ireland. From 2010 to 2016, the number of international arrivals at New Chitose Airport went from 362,000 to 1.1 million. In response, the airport administration enlarged the international terminal. 3 years later, the number of arrivals reached 1.7 million, so the airport enlarged the international terminal again. Anticipating that this boom would continue, in January 2020, a luxury hotel was added. Then the pandemic struck, and by March, everything was shut down. Now, more than 2 years later, plastic covers still remain on the check-in counters. The tourist office is shuttered. The arrivals board forlornly flashes details of flights that haven't flown since 2020. You only notice this because all the other lights in the terminal have been turned off. For 2 years, Japan effectively closed its borders to the outside world. Only Japanese citizens and long-term residents were permitted to enter the country, and then only if they followed an extremely stringent quarantine process. In March of this year, the government finally eased some of these restrictions. Business people and foreign students were allowed to enter the country, though their numbers were capped at 10,000 arrivals a day. At the start of June, this cap was raised to 20,000 arrivals, and most of the quarantine requirements were abolished. And then, with what passes for indecent haste here in Japan, last Friday tourists were also permitted to visit the country. Or rather, a select few tourists are permitted to visit a select few parts of Japan. For a start, tourists are included in that cap of 20,000 daily arrivals. This figure includes not just foreigners, but also Japanese citizens returning to Japan. To put this in perspective, pre-pandemic arrivals in Japan averaged over 100,000 people a day. Tourists can only come from 98 designated safe countries, one of which is Ireland. All tourists must be part of an official guided package tour, and they will need a tourist visa and a negative PCR test result 72 hours prior to flying to Japan, and mandatory coronavirus travel insurance as well. Once in the country, the rules, you'll be glad to hear, continue. The government has instructed tour agencies to avoid crowded areas, submit comprehensive travel itineraries, and record the details of anyone whom the tourists come in contact with. Tour companies are also required to draw up comprehensive contingency plans in case any of the visitors do catch COVID whilst in Japan. Nor can tourists just simply wander off. They must strictly adhere to their specific tour itinerary or risk being fined and deported. And then there are masks. Simply put, whilst in Japan, you will have to wear one all of the time. All these rules and restrictions are as much politically motivated as they are medically justified. National elections are scheduled for July, and the ruling Liberal Democratic Party does not want to rile its elderly voter base by seemingly throwing COVID caution to the winds. Its slowly, slowly approach reflects the apathy of many Japanese, particularly in rural areas, to a sudden influx of foreigners. For many Japanese people, the onset of the coronavirus is associated with the Diamond Princess, the ill-fated cruise ship that was the center of the first serious outbreak of the disease in Japan. Yet the government is also conscious of the economic impact international tourism has. In 2019, there were close on 32 million visitors to Japan, who contributed over 11 trillion yen to the economy. Since then, the hard-hit tourism and hospitality sector has borne the brunt of the repeated lockdowns the country has endured. Many hotels and restaurants would very much like to see that money return. The question, of course, is, will it return? The prolonged pandemic and the war in Ukraine have led to a steep rise in inflation and a souring of consumer sentiment. International travel increasingly seems like an extravagance in these challenging times. Last Friday, then, can be best understood as the first tentative step towards a wider reopening. In New Chitose Airport, there is growing optimism that the worst is over. The first international flight in over 2 years is due to arrive at the end of this month. Time, then, to turn the lights back on. For World Report, this is Brian Gaynor in Hokkaido, in northern Japan.
To the island of Tenerife next, and in many parts of the world, the Feast of Corpus Christi is marked with traditional floral carpets. The same goes for the Canary Islands, where depending on the town or village you're in, the carpet might be made of salt or sand from the local volcano. These are elaborately designed and handcrafted, but last less than a day, as Cliona O'Flynn reports now from Tenerife.
If Lot's wife had stolen a quick glance on her way out of Tenerife, she might have been transformed into a salt carpet quicker than you can say Sodom and Gomorrah. All around the Canary Islands, family and community groups are beginning to work on their designs and think about dyeing salt, sand, or gathering the petals that they are going to need to create the amazing Corpus Christi carpets that have become such an integral part of this religious celebration here. These incredible confections happen in towns and villages all over the islands. And having taken part over a number of years as part of different community groups, I began to realise why some traditions are not dying out in these small Spanish islands. They are fun. The religion is often an excuse to bring people together. Yes, there will be mass and priests and recently communioned children parading, but the carpet makers are there to create something colourful, unique to the day, and to meet those working on carpets above and below them. So it's a carpet get-together. Where did it all begin? Probably with the Monteverde family in La Retava, one of the major cities in Tenerife, in 1847. A family of Italian descent, it is believed the tradition was brought from their native country by the Monteverdes. In fact, just this week, a descendant of the family, Agustin Monteverde, was in the city to thank the town hall for continuing the tradition and to present them and the families of the carpet makers with a document showing there had been processions in honour of Corpus Christi there as far back as 1536. Today, the chief La Retava carpet stretches over 900 square metres, the full width of the plaza, and is an incredible creation with different designs each year, combining religious and humanitarian themes, all made with petals, coloured sea salt and sand from Mount Teide, the island's volcano. This year, the ancillary themes are peace in Ukraine, with the colours of the flag visible in the design, and the recovery of La Palma following the months-long volcanic eruption there in the second half of 2021. Ash from that volcano will be used in creating the carpet too. This carpet will be made over weeks, with Alfombristas carpet makers starting to work on the grid of the design now, probably with their families, as this is a skill that is passed down through generations. And when it's all complete, it will be on view to the public on June 23rd and then paraded over after religious Corpus Christi ceremonies. But in other small towns and villages, the designs and carpet making is left to community groups and it's more of a get-together. Here in our town of Adeje, the Calle Grande, the main tree-lined street that leads to the town hall and the parish church, is the location for a street-long linked series of carpets with different designs for each group this year. Spaces are allocated for those invited to participate. In our case, with other non-Spanish residents, it's a challenge, as few of us have done this before. We need to go and attend a short workshop on how to mix the colours into the salt we will need for the design that we have chosen. Overall, in our town, we'll use up to 445 sacks of sea salt, or just over 11,000 kilos of the stuff. Once the design has been chosen, the colours mixed, the carpet itself has to be laid. This year, it's all happening here on June 18th. On that Saturday, the main street is closed and people begin to arrive from about 5 o'clock, and coordination is key. The organiser of each carpet needs to make sure people know what they are doing, which section they are working on, and how fine to lay the layer of salt. It's a bit backbreaking, this from experience, but there's nothing that brings people together more than sharing a kilo of coloured sea salt. The public stroll up and down watching the groups at work, and often kids will ask if they can help, ensuring maybe that the next generation are already thinking about getting involved. People bring picnics, check each other's carpet out with approval, help if needed with swapping coloured bags of salt. Some designs will be more intricate than others, some religious, some not, but it doesn't matter too much, and each small salt rug will form a huge singular carpet stretching down the street. Some carpet makers will be there until the wee hours putting the final touches to their carpets, while others are long gone. And the next day, these are very transient creations. Sunday, June the 19th, following the midday mass, there is a huge procession over these lovingly created carpets, and by late afternoon they're gone, cleaned away. The traffic has taken over the streets again for another year. For World Report, this is Cleanne O'Flynn in Tenerife.
Finally, we go to Denmark, where in the capital, Copenhagen, motorists are going to have to get used to going slower. The speed limits in the city will now be lowered in many places from the normal 50 kilometres an hour down to 30. The idea is to make driving less attractive and was born in the offices of the far-left transportation mayor. And it is not met with approval from all sides, to put it mildly. Neither have the changing national policies on electric cars in Denmark, which have resulted in an uncertain market for companies building infrastructure for electric vehicles. From Copenhagen, Tom Carstensen reports.
As in many big cities, driving in Copenhagen is often a source of frustration, slow pace and what feels like eternal traffic jams. There are more cars than ever, and this is laid out to be one of the reasons for new legislation in the Danish capital, lowering speed limits by a large percentage. Standard national legislation says you can drive 50 kilometres an hour in city zones. This is now being changed in Copenhagen. In most of Copenhagen, the limit will now be lower to 40 kilometres per hour, and in the large inner city areas, it'll be down to as little as 30. This is between 20 and 40% lower than the national limits. This also means that you can lose your license at very low speeds in the future. If you drive 49 kilometers per hour, you are now to lose your license in a 30 kilometer zone, due to Danish license laws. Copenhagen's council has a Lord Mayor and then six sub-mayors. The Mayor for Traffic and Environment, Line Barfod, says that the aim is to lower emissions. She is from the far-left party Enhedslisten, which is made up by socialists and communists. The aim is clear, to get fewer cars in the city. Her administration writes in a public paper that by lowering the speed limits, it's expected to be less attractive to use a car because of longer commuting times. She is met by much critique by some. One of them is Carsten Lauritsen. He's a former MP for centre-right Liberal Party Venstre and now Vice Director of the Confederation of Danish Industry. To local TV station TV2 Lorry, he says that while there can be sensible arguments for lowering the speed limit when it comes to noise and accidents, it has other consequences. It will make the commute to work for many longer, and that means less productivity, and someone has to pay that bill, he says. He also notes it'll impact the distribution of goods in the city. It'll be slower and more expensive. Car owners are also critical. FDM, the Car Owner Association, is not happy with the new rules, and they see it as yet another attack on private car owners in the city. The new rules come after years of criticism of rising parking license fees in the city. These have risen in the hundreds of percent in the latter years, making many car owners in the city feel unwelcome. It's not just speed limits that are upsetting some motorists. Moving over to electric cars is not without its challenges. Denmark is, as elsewhere, turning towards a more electric future. On a trial basis, some streets in Copenhagen are now banned for cars running on fossil fuels. And it is the council's idea to get as many to switch to electric cars as possible. But this is not without obstacles. The central government is not always on the same page as the local one. There are major issues in Denmark when it comes to the infrastructure that shall support the many future electric cars. There's a big lack of charging stations, and the Danish tax laws on cars has also been a source of confusion. Normal car tax in Denmark is quite steep. Of the factory price up to 9,000 euros, car tax is 25%. Then it rises to 85% up to 19,000 euros, and anything above is taxed with 150%. So if you buy a less than small car, you're not in for a cheap ride. To urge people to buy more electric cars, the tax has previously been lowered on these. But the problem is, it's been changed so much, people don't know what to think. At one point, electric cars had no tax, so you could get a Tesla for an amount that was very low compared to what you would have to pay for a luxury fossil fuel car. But then the tax changed, and then it changed again. As a result of that, companies that are building the charging stations, and thereby the infrastructure, have been reluctant to invest in this market because of the constant change in legislation. So as it has been for many years, traffic politics in Denmark is the source of many fierce debates and confusion, and it doesn't seem to be changing anytime soon. For World Report, this is Tom Carstensen in Copenhagen.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.